Brevity codes are designed to convey complex information with a few words or codes. Think of it as a short hack to key information. On this podcast, it's about sharing insights, success stories, and personal journeys across a broad spectrum of disciplines. Welcome to the Brevity Code. Well, hello and welcome. We are back with the Brevity Code. It's been a minute. I've got a great bunch of guests lined up, especially starting today with my dad, which is going to be a bit unusual in that I am woven into a guest story for the first time. We're going to see how this goes. We're going to have some fun. He's got a great story. This is not charity. My dad is a very accomplished entrepreneur, businessman with a great story, a very compelling story that I think is worth sharing. Obviously, I know it very well, and it's been really inspirational for me in my life. But I think it's time that maybe he shares some business secrets and some of the motivations behind his success. So, Dad, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Roy. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So I think we can kind of just jump right in here. Again, it's a little unusual that I'm doing this in that I'm woven into your story in a very intimate way. But today it's my goal to kind of keep this more about you and your journey. And there is going to be a couple of points where later on, we're going to talk about some of my business endeavors and how you played a role in those. So I think probably for the sake of starting and foundation, maybe just give us some background on your origin story to kind of set this up for today.
Okay. I was thinking about what I might say today, and I'm thinking, well, I'm 74 years old, so I have to cut this down. But origin stories, just briefly, I was born in Boston in December of 1949, and didn't come to California till I was about three. And I was born to a first-generation Italian father and mother, first generation. They came over on the boat. Never knew my real father. It's kind of a sad part of my life. But basically, I was stolen by a fellow who became my stepfather and my mother, and we came west. And that's kind of where I kicked off my life. And gosh, wherever we go from here, wasn't a great childhood, needless to say. My stepfather was a tough guy, one of 10 boys in his family. And my mom was a very supportive Italian mother, had a little Italian grandmother hanging out, so I learned a lot about Italy, spoke a little of the language, understood. So I'm really proud of that heritage. Yet here I am with a German last name. And interestingly enough, I didn't know any of this. I really didn't know until I brought a birth certificate to sign up for Little League, and it had a different name on it. And I thought, jeez, who's that? And that's when I was told that, yeah, he's not your real dad. So that was an eye-opener. And kind of kicked off my childhood that way.
Yeah, I know some of the story that we will not share today, but I didn't realize the Little League birth certificate was kind of the kicking off point for you. You didn't know that. I never heard that story before. So yeah, definitely came from more, you know, from very humble beginnings, clearly adversity from the get-go, not having a dad and then blindsided one day that this is actually not your dad. And, you know, I remember you told me a story that you said to your mom that you were going to be rich someday and you were going to have a house on the water. And, you know, I think a lot of kids say that, and it's a grandiose statement. And, but you actually did that. Like, you know, how did you call that out from such an early age? Or was that just kind of you talking back then? Or did you really kind of know, like, this situation's not going to define me?
Yeah, I think I went inside real young in my life and realized that I was on my own. While I have one full sister and two stepsisters, sadly lost one of the stepsisters in a car accident in 77. But I realized that I was on my own from a very early age. And somehow I got the impression that instead of hearing my parents arguing and yelling about money all the time, which really, really was traumatic in my life, I hated it. I thought, I'm going to be different. Didn't know exactly how, but I had this feeling there's another way. And I kept that to myself. And Ryan recants the story of me telling my mother that, yeah, you know, Mom, one day I'm going to have a big house. I'm going to have beautiful yards. I remember visualizing the whole thing. And I think visualization actually has become a big part of my life's journey. And as we're talking about it, it sort of defines how I see the road ahead and has served me well.
That's a long view visualization from, I mean, how old were you when you were starting to have these thoughts that this is my path. I don't know how I'm going to get there, but I know I'm going to get there. Were you a teenager? Were you?
Yeah. Well, obviously, you know, like a lot of my contemporaries that time, it was kind of a different time. I mean, I had an abusive father, hitting, nothing other than that. And he, I, for whatever reason, didn't like that little kid. And so that probably started early on. So I started having thoughts of being on my own, probably 7, 8, 9,
wow.
10, yeah. For yeah. Sure in that area.
Yeah, obviously a different time period, but that's still, man, that's a lot for a little guy to be thinking about. So you've told me growing up, you know, one of the things you would like to say to me was, you know, sometimes you have to take a job that you don't like to find out, or no, you, sometimes you got to take a job to find out what it is you don't like to do. you want to take us through some of the, you know, you've had probably some, I know some, you were a plumber. I think you bagged groceries.
I had, you know, needless to say, the environment was anything that I was going to have as a little kid, I had to earn on my own. And again, I don't consider myself a victim or anything that unusual for the lifetime for what I would call a lower income upbringing. So, you know, basically it started real, real young, you know, cutting lawns to paper routes to finding empty bottles to cash in. And my first real jobs were, I actually had, they hired me. My dad was a plumber, so he would drag me around to the jobs that he was on, and I dug ditches, schlepped tools, basically learned what it was like to plumb a house. I hated it. Mentally, it wasn't very stimulating. But I did that in the 12, 13, 14 kind of era. So my summers were consumed with that kind of work. And I remember clearly sitting there thinking at lunch when the guys would sit there with their lunch pail, good guys, hardworking men. It just wasn't for me. I thought, this is just not where I see myself. Didn't know how I was going to get out of that. But I did that. As a matter of fact, I studied, took a test, and actually got my apprentice plumber's license. And ultimately turned that into a journeyman. Never worked as a journeyman. But that's what I did. I knew that's what I didn't want to do.
Yeah. So let's move to where you meet mom. I come into your life. So I think you are now putting yourself through school, working full-time, raising me. Do you still feel at that point in your life good about this long view vision? Like, I'm still going to make it. Are you bogged down in the dailies of, oh geez, I got a newborn and I'm still a kid myself. Like how is that time period for you?
Yeah. I mean, you know, reflecting on that, just to finish up on my job stuff, I took a job at a local grocery market. I would box groceries, and then a job opening came as a janitor, paid, I think it was 25 cents an hour more, and I jumped at it. So I was a janitor working the graveyard shift so that when the store opened, it was clean. And then on the weekends, I would work in construction. But I always had this thing I wanted to put myself through school, because nobody in our family that I was aware of had any education. So that became very important to me. And I started out going to school. I started out going to a junior college, Pasadena City College, so I could also work full-time. And at 19 years old, I met your mother, beautiful girl, Valenzano, this Italian girl, and we dated. I dated a little bit outside of that, and then it just occurred to me that I have to continue on my quest. So at 19 and a half, I actually found out about this program. You could buy a house for closing costs, $450. And I bought a small little house in Covina, got married when I was 20. Ryan came along a couple years later. So here I am. I'm now transferred to a four-year college. I'm working full-time, construction. I'm married. And I have this kid that never stopped crying.
Yeah.
And I'm 20 years old. It's everything my life was on track to move. So that's kind of where I started.
Yeah. So we're talking about, you know, this vision, and I've had it as well. We'll get to mine angle later. Did you have a mentor along the way? Like, how there's a leap, right, between being getting a plumbing apprenticeship, working in a grocery store, being a janitor, and having the motivation and determination to better yourself, better your life, but you're bogged down with a lot of responsibility, going to school, you have me. Did you have a mentor? Was there anyone that you looked to that could help guide you on that difficult path at that very formative age?
Not yet. So just briefly, that is my mom and my stepdad. We were invited to a distant, sort of a second uncle to me. It was a cousin to my mother. And he came out from Boston, highly educated guy. His name was Joseph Alibrandi. Joe Alibrandi was hired by Whitaker Corporation, which was a major conglomerate. And I didn't know any of that at that time. And he and I hit it off at this Easter dinner that we got invited to. And he lived up in Brentwood. I've never seen a house like that. Big old view. I thought, oh my God. This guy was an MIT engineer, and then I believe he also got a doctorate from Harvard in business. And he was in his early 40s and was asked to chair Whitaker, which was a huge conglomerate at the time, and they needed him. He worked at Raytheon. Anyways, he and I got into this conversation, and I called him later on the phone and told him, based on our phone conversation, is there anything in the hundreds of companies he has that he thinks could use my talent? He said, whoa, yes. He said, we have a guy by the name of George Hunter, never forget him, who is in charge of industrial relations, basically union stuff. He said, sent me a letter, said, call George Hunter and meet with him. So I went to their corporate offices. That was another wake-up call. I've never seen offices like that. These are these tall, plush corporate offices. And Hunter says, well, we don't know what you can do. He says, but we have staff psychologists. Let's give you some battery of tests and find out what you can do. I said, okay. So 2 days worth of tests. And sure enough, it came back and George gets the results. And we were sitting there and he says, well, we've never had one like this. I said, what's that? And he said, well, you're best suited to be a YMCA director. I said, oh, okay. Yeah, that sounds good. I like sports. I got this. He said, well, we're a for-profit company. So lo and behold, he introduced me to a gentleman named Ray Gould, who worked out of one of their Chicago Steel operations. And that's how I got my start in the steel business.
Yeah. So let's get into that a little bit, because it's pretty fascinating trajectory from there. So, you know, as a kid growing up, I just remembered, yeah, you were in the stainless steel business, held a variety of jobs, and don't want to give away the punchline here. So maybe give us a sense of that trajectory and growth from the time you get your foot in the door and then what happens.
Yeah. Well, just briefly, I meet with Ray Gould, and he wanted me to leave school, drop everything, and go to work as a sales rep, basically, and open up on the West Coast because they were selling in other parts of the country. And he sold the more expensive metals, the aluminums, stainless, copper, and a little bit of steel. And I did a quick study on what that was. And I said, no, I'm not going to quit all that stuff, but I can do what you want me to do. And I remember asking him the question, and I know I've told this to my kids and my grandkids. During my interview, he said, well, no, I need somebody full time. And I said, right. Tell me what kind of business you expect me to do. And he said, well, if in 3 months you're not doing $50,000 a month in sales, it's not worth it. Well, I said, okay, is that fair? He said, yeah, that's fair. I said, okay, I'll tell you what. If I'm not doing $50,000 a month in 3 months, you don't pay me. I'll work for free. But just let me do it on my time. I'll work. Because I can set my school schedule to finish up at night, get my bachelor's during the day, and I'll achieve whatever it is you think. Well, between everybody. I knew they were a big company and he probably couldn't do that, but I know it sounded good. And I think that really caught him. And that's how I got started. And we opened up on the West Coast. I acted as a broker out of some of their offices. And we became so successful out here, we actually opened up a separate division. So here I am now, a 22-year-old, and I'm a general manager for a small distribution center in Los Angeles. And that started my metal business career with Whitaker.
And when do you continue that path? And was that the company that you eventually became, I don't know, part of the C-suite there? Or was that?
No, what happened was at that time, I began learning how to source, how to sell, how to warehouse, how to process. It was PhD condensed. And I decided after a couple, 2-3 years of doing this for Whitaker that I could do this on my own. Mm. And I had met and become friendly with a young gentleman by the name of Yoshi Higuchi. At that time, trading companies were big sources of financing. And Yoshi was a trading company, worked for Kanamatsu Gosho, which was a fairly large, in the top 10 for sure. And I told him, I said, listen, we can do this without Whitaker. I said, if you'll just consign inventory to me, when I sell it, I'll pay you. You can make more money. He loved the idea, but I had to go sell that to his superiors. And sure enough, that's what we did. And when I put it all together, they offered me at least double or triple what it was that I was looking for. And that's how I started in my own business. But I needed an entity. I didn't have an entity. I was kind of weak there on how to do this on my own. So there had been a couple of gentlemen that had a small metal business and they'd been trying to hire me. Instead, I went over there and figured out a way to buy in a third of the business and bring this consignment deal I had, which I did. And we grew exponentially. And the two partners were quite a bit older than I was, 15 or 20 years. And they were each coming to me to buy the other one out. I learned how well partners get along at that point. And I decided to stay with one partner, and the other partner left. And we grew that business into one of the biggest in SoCal distributors for aluminum and stainless steel. And then we had a big processing center.
Was that Circle Metals?
That was Circle Metals.
And so how old are you at that time?
I'm now from 24 years old to 30 years old.
Okay. And so again, some of this stuff just doesn't seem like it's an accident. And it's pretty amazing when you think about, again, what we were just recounting earlier with some of your childhood and some of the adversity there to, you know, having a mentor, getting a break at getting your foot in the door, and then really excelling in those roles and networking and, you know, learning all the various aspects of the business. I mean, that's not necessarily normal pattern. You know, if you think about how quickly that growth happened too, how fast, it's always like you were sort of meant for it, but there's a driving force. And just another example, now I'm a little kid and I clearly don't know any of this is happening, but what I did see was dad, you know, running before work, up the coast from PCH, and I would get on my bike and ride next to you when you were running. And then on the weekends, you know, you were going to the gym. And going to the gym, you know, in the early 80s wasn't like going to the gym now. There was no CrossFit. There was no community. There was no sort of rah-rah aspect, or no one was talking about health and wellness. But what I equate that to is hard work and discipline and having stated goals and just staying in that lane. And again, where do you think that comes from?
Well, this is a very interesting exercise we're doing here, Ryan, because you and I have really never talked about how you felt about all this. You know, in retrospect, just to back up just a bit, Ryan, of course, had a sister 3 years later, my beautiful daughter, Kelly. And we had, needless to say, started in a starter home in Huntington Beach, and I kept trading up to nicer homes. And here I am, this 20-something-year-old living in the best neighborhoods in Orange County. And in hindsight, I was a little bit absent as a father in those days, which is painful to think of sometimes. Probably a little bit out of selfishness. A lot to do with my drive to build a business and the security, or the get rid of the insecurity. And it was the perfect storm to succeed. Things were just hitting. And I knew I had to be at the top of my game. And there were plenty of competitors with pedigree, with legacy, been in business a long time, and we were the newcomers. And I just felt like we needed to be the most aggressive. We needed to be the most professional. I needed to portray an image of I'm there for everybody. I had to learn that what felt good for me has to feel good for the rest of the team. So I did a lot of team building. In hindsight, that part of my career was fun. It was just fun. And that's where that went. And as I say, you know, juggling a booming career now and raising a family, you know, it has its challenges for sure. I'm not quite 30.
So that's Circle Metals era, and then Reliance is after.
Yeah, well, what happened was my partner, the one that I was left with, sadly, he was an alcoholic, and I just had enough of his mistakes. And I couldn't deal with him, and I wanted to get rid of him. And Reliance Steel and Aluminum Company, the founder was a guy by the name of Bill Gimbel, was after me to sell my business because he was a serial acquirer of businesses. And we hit his radar screen early on, and he knew me well. I was active in the associations for the industry and what have you. And I finally called him and said, well, my partner is no bueno. He's still interested in buying us. And, of course, he jumped. And we put together a deal, and he bought us. And we had acquired real estate at that time. Wished I'd have hung on to it, but he packaged the real estate with it. We had a very large industrial building in Carson. And that was in 1983. Company was worth several million dollars. And they made me the combined manager of his large branch that was a competitor of mine. So we combined them. That too was a great experience for me, trying to figure out how to bring two companies together that were cutting each other's throats to now becoming one. Mm. Well, historically, from 1983 to 1989, those were the Ronald Reagan years, and the economy just boomed, just boomed. And so I rode that trajectory, and they just thought I was infallible.
Mm.
And everything we touched turned to gold. So I had a contract that was going to expire in 5 years, and I was going to leave and start my own business. I had already figured it out and had it, plans and what have you. And they made me an offer I couldn't refuse. So we started a whole branch in that area, and I became president and CEO. And I was in my mid-30s at that point.
Which is, again, going back, you know, not much more than a decade. You're right now in this role, and you have two kids, and you're, I mean, you're really, you're living the dream that you proposed to your mom when you were a kid. You're doing it.
Yeah. Yeah, we already had it. And in 1990 and 1991, the economy started to go south. And I am now on a public board. And while they were holding ticker tape parades for me the prior 6-7 years, now I'm kind of the fall guy. And of course, if you know anything about the metals business, it's very commodity driven, has to do with, you know, when the prices are going up, you, and you're holding big inventories, you win. Conversely, when it goes down, you lose. So I saw the handwriting on the wall and decided to resign in 1991 and venture out.
Yeah. And so there's some personal life turmoil at that point in your life as well, which, you know, looking back, look, let's call it what it is. That's your average midlife crisis situation. So you pivot, you're golfing a lot. You probably were single digits. Everything's good on that front, but let's get into again, where you have a nose for what you end up being as your next career, which is SAS safety. And that, so you're, let me take you to you're golfing with your future partner, and I'll let you go from there.
Yeah. Just to kind of segue back, you know, I think a lot of what drives our nose and the direction that we go, in my case, was driven out of that whole insecurity base as a child.
Mm.
And that never left me. Maybe it's still with me today. It's faint, but it's probably there. And I just never wanted to let it catch up with me. I think married for 20 plus years now, two beautiful kids. One's already started college. The other one's finishing high school. And my then wife and I talk about the things missing in our marriage and decided it's probably best if I go off on my own. Highly traumatic time for me. You know, in a divorce, it doesn't matter who initiates it. It's painful for all parties, kids, parents, everybody. So here I am. I mean, I went from flying in chairman of Alcoa's private jet to no job. And Yeah, I had met a fellow at the club that I belonged to playing golf, and he had this really small little business where he supplied safety equipment to jobber stores that ultimately sold it into collision repair centers, or bump shops, as I called them. And he and I were just hanging out for a while. I had a year non-compete, so I couldn't go back in the metal business, but I was going crazy. I had to find a new career. I was, you know, 40 years old, and I needed to get established. And he said, well, you know what? Go down to my business and tell me what I'm doing wrong. You seem to be very good at that kind of thing. Well, I went down to this little shop that he had, and I spent a couple of days and then had lunch with him and said, well, you're basically out of business. Your key two or three people are leaving and going into their own business, and your bank's calling the loans, and your biggest customers are leaving. I said, you're screwed. And he said, well, good. That's why you're here. I go, oh, no. I'm not. No, I have no interest in being in the safety business. Well, lo and behold, I ended up staying, which meant I bought half the company. And basically, for a very insignificant amount, it was more trading, that I would cure his loans. I would stabilize the business. I would talk to the bank. In other words, I just put it on hold. Now, here, I'm now in charge of running a business I know nothing about. And this teeny little startup, and it was odd.
What do you think were some of the, so, I mean, I get that, like, going from a business where you know inside and out and you know every aspect to, you know, now going into business, you know nothing. There's got to be, I mean, there's some business mechanics that are similar, like, right, balance sheets look like a balance sheet, inventory looks like inventory, but that had to be so intimidating.
Yeah, that's funny you bring that up, and thought just occurred to me. So I said to the partner, who was basically checked out of the business, and he's had a couple of employees that were really knew what they were doing, and I said, guys, tell me, I said, give me the name of three people in your industry, not necessarily competitors, like people that are in your industry that really know the industry that we're in. Give me their names and their phone numbers. Oh, so they came up with three names. And systematically, I called them all and said, I just want to introduce myself, what I'm doing, and I'd like to buy a sandwich, if I could pick your brains for 30 minutes and find out what PBE means. And it was paint, body, and equipment. I mean, I could have never guessed what that was. And that's what I did. And out of it, actually, to this day, I made a really good friend. He ran a company that made paint guns, which is so arbitrary to what I was doing. So I got a quick education on the business, the industry.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think about, you know, keys to your success. It sounds like, you know, not being intimidated ultimately, or I don't know if it's so, it goes so deep. That's like the insecurity thing was there to the point where you're like, I can't be exposed. I have to make this work. I'm going to figure it out. Right. I mean, on some deep level, but clearly there's some great stuff there. Like this drive to succeed. You see this fledgling floundering business. But again, I feel like you intuitively know, I know what to do here. I just intuitively know. But so what do you think some of those keys are? Like, what do you think you honed in on that? Or what do you think you possess that?
So
that
those
helps
are such great questions, Ryan. I'm impressed. Yeah. Yeah. So I remember shortly after that, I got, now listen, we have a total of 12 employees and seven of them were in the warehouse part. So the rest, a couple of, you know, clerical, and I mean, we had a teeny little operation, and I got the group together and I said, listen, I have discovered that we can't be in business unless we can answer a few questions. And I said this in a group. I said, it seems to me we have to be really important to our customers. And if we're not important to our customers, we have to give them a reason to want to buy from us. We have the best quality. We have the best price. We have the best service. We have the best niche. We have the best something, but the person that we considered at that time our biggest competitor was 3M. 3M was a campus.
Yeah.
I mean, it was, yeah. And nobody had ever
publicly
heard.
Traded probably at that time already, right?
Oh, yeah. Sure. They yeah. were one of the biggest Fortune 500 companies on the exchange, highly successful and innovative company. Yeah. So I said, unless we can answer that question, we can't be in business. So we got busy trying to answer that question.
Yeah.
And one of the things that went along with that is I said, in order for us to thrive, since we don't make anything, we're a spec engineer, we buy everything. I said to the gentleman who ended up being our president, Kenny, I said to Kenny, I said, why are we sourcing everything in the United States? I said, there's a tsunami coming from China. And he said to me, I'll never forget, we talk about this. He said, well, nobody's going to buy from China. Mm. Nobody's going to use things that are made in China. And I said, I think you're going to be surprised. And I had a head start because I was in the metal business sourcing from all over the world. Mm-hmm. And even though China wasn't sourcing raw material, I just knew what was coming. And so I said, well, let's find out. So we did. And then my next question was, who's the biggest? If we had the biggest customer in the country, who would it be? Mm. And they said, well, that would be Napa Auto Parts. They have 96 distribution centers and 7,000 stores. They have the biggest footprint in the country, maybe North America. I said, good. I'll go after Napa. I have no idea what that meant. So we had our marching orders. Find out why we're important to our customers and how do we develop scale.
Mm. Yes. And so obviously you do. You grab Napa. You get them.
I did. I somehow got myself in front of some of the decision makers and convinced them that they were missing out on revenue in this safety business for masks and protective eyewear and protective hearing and suits and so on and so forth. And I did a study for them, because remember, people do business because it's good for them, not because it's good for you.
Right.
And they gave us a shot. They gave little SAS a shot. And that was like hitting lotto. Now we had to perform. And I had to pick up all their old inventory. I had no idea how much they had. But I said, I don't care. I'll buy it. I'll take it back. And we're going to put all my stuff in your system.
That's high stakes decision making.
That was gut. And if it came in way above our pay grade, I don't know what we were going to do.
Right.
But we again navigated those waters. And when we ultimately sold that business, they were by far our biggest customer and our most profitable customer. And, we did many, many, many millions of dollars worth of business.
Yeah. So SAS becomes a huge success. You also had the vision to, you bought the dirt and built the building. I think you cobbled that together too. I don't, I don't want to speak for you, but I don't think the funds were exactly there for that to happen either, right? To build that building right next to the 405 freeway, greatest advertising you could have done.
Yeah. As we go along here and these things are rekindled, I remember thinking we moved twice, we kept upsizing. And certainly by then we had a network of representatives, we added employees. And about this time, my then partner was completely dislocated from the business. And we came to a point where I thought maybe it was time for one of us to leave, because he wasn't the business guy. And I knew that. He's a terrific guy, and was a good friend. And I told him to go home and think about, you buy me or I'll buy you. But the one thing you need to think about, Jim, is can you run this business? And to his credit, his answer to me was, I don't need to go home and think about it. I know I can't.
Yeah.
And lack of ego is such a great thing sometimes.
Yeah.
And we did that. We worked out a very equitable sales price, and Jim left, and I became 100% owner. And we were still growing. We were picking up accounts left and right, and our name became recognizable within the industry. And every day on the way to work, I would drive past this big empty field, and I thought, God, that would be the perfect place to build a sort of a home base for this booming business. And sure enough, I was able to tie up that property, which was going to the Mercedes dealer because they needed freeway frontage. And the Mercedes dealer backed out because the city of Signal Hill made them an offer they couldn't refuse because they wanted the sales tax. And I tracked down the owner. They happened to be in Niagara Falls area, Buffalo. And we put together a deal for them to do a build-a-suit. And we built a 90,000-foot beautiful facility on their dime.
How do you orchestrate that? I mean, how do you get those kind of terms?
The owner said, well, I got to keep it for a year so he could avoid short-term cap gain. And I said, fine, we'll lease it for a year with an option to buy. Gave him a lot of options. And then when 1 year was up, we'd figured out a way to buy the building. We'd developed great banking relationships, and the environment was right, and we bought it.
Mm. It's unbelievable. I mean, really.
And we designed it.
Yeah. No, it's a great spot. Again, great location. Amazing. Never to be repeated. So we've talked a lot about trajectory and sort of this unwavering discipline you've had, and this sort of great instinct, but there had to be along the way some colossal fails. Does anything,
oh my God,
right? Is there any one particular event or situation come to mind where you're just like, oh, that was pretty colossal and almost, you know, sank a ship?
Yes, yes. You might recall, for those of you, whoever gets to hear this or see this, there were the days of 240Zs, that Datsun, I guess, that came out. It was kind of a little sports version, and they had these aluminum louvers on the back windows. Well, back into my old metal days, my then partner decided to supply all those and extended huge lines of credit with him. Well, they went bankrupt, and we were stuck with over $1 million, $1.5 million of a bad receivable. Well, that just came plucking right out of cash flow on in the metal business. So we had to overcome that. That was a big lesson.
But that doesn't sound like it was your decision necessarily.
It wasn't. However, was my decision was I took my eye off the ball in terms of what was going on in the accounting department,
right,
who we were giving credit to, and I had my eye on buying and selling. And I realized it, all facets of the business were important. What's going on in the plant? What's going on in the accounting department? You can't be one-dimensional.
I think that's a really important lesson that I still don't think I was very good at either.
I don't either.
Thanks for the reinforcement there. You know, when we were starting to do several million a year and we were growing the international business and everything was good, you were saying, hey, look, keep your eye on finance, because when the rocket ship eventually is no longer a rocket ship, you know, if you don't have systems and ducks in a row, you're going to shrink and ultimately could fail. And you really have to have an understanding of the financial piece. And I'm a creative, you know that. Spreadsheets and I are not friends. It's still something I don't love. And, you know, that was hard to hear that it was great sage advice. And I feel like I would dive into it and I would not understand fully what was happening. And I mean, I remember I would just have our CFO take the meetings with the bankers. I wouldn't even bother to go in there. I would shake their hand, say hi, and then leave and just go back and sit in my office and just feel like a loser. And I don't know why. I think I have pretty good common sense. You know, I have a strong enough grasp of the business to kind of understand the mechanics of what was said, but I think some of the nuance, the finance just was really intimidating. So that was a hard thing to hear from you. And I felt like I was disappointing you, by not knowing that.
But before we get there, and I'm so glad we're going to segue away from me. I hate talking about me for that long, and segue into you. But can I digress for one moment? Because if I neglect to say this, I'm going to be out on the streets. I met my amazing wife right around this time and remarried in 1994, before all this SAS growth. And she really had, we met at a very low point of my personal life and career. And she's amazing and was amazing. And we're about to celebrate our 30th anniversary in a couple weeks. So, and we have a beautiful young lady, Lexi, who just turned 27. So she was part of that journey through SAS with me, and it'd be a shame on me for not putting that in there.
Yeah. And it's worth noting for sure, you know, those of you interested in the Paul Frank story, there's other podcasts on Brevity Code and others you can listen, or my TED talk. Kim, his wife, she was my savior. She, when I went to you for, you know, hey, I want to start this business, ultimately it was a no. And she happened to be in the other room, like literally, like if this doesn't happen, there's no business, there's no career, there's no global brand. It's crazy. And she says, how much do you need? And I said, well, we just need $5,000 to just attend a trade show, buy some business cards. We've made all the product. And she said, you know, I'll do it. And she happened, again, this is another just weird coincidence, that she happened to be in the apparel business as a very successful retailer and really like kind of understood what I think I was driving at, what I was trying to do. And you were more like practical, which I don't blame you. And it, in your recap of it, says it perfectly, which was something to the effect of, let me get this straight. You want to borrow $5,000, leave your great job, go to work with a guy that works at a newspaper stand making vinyl wallets with monkeys on them. So
I think I said effing monkeys.
Yeah. I'm cleaning that up. Yeah. So, but you know, again, I've now got, you know, three kids of my own and my son's almost 16, and I could see him coming up to me with something that crazy. And I don't know that I would have much of a different response. you know, it's out of love. You're like, oh boy, this, I got to just, we got to stop this from even happening. So I get that. And I mean, I was had a kind of like you. I mean, I came out of school. I worked my way up from a warehouse and landed a insanely great job, something that was far beyond what I should have deserved at that point in my career. I had two crazy bosses. You know, one, I don't, he married a supermodel, moved to the south of France, just this most extravagant, like Johnny Depp character you've ever met, who just inspired me to really think, like I thought I was kind of a, you know, an alternative thinker, but this guy was so next level. And to see the behavior of that in a corporate environment, to be that creative and that magical, was really let the restrictor plate off me, where I was like, whoa, okay. I thought I had boundaries, but now the boundaries are way more expanded. And then his boss, who is Massimo, who's a buddy of yours and, you know, is an extremely bright guy who's right and left brained and could, you know, annihilate a legal document and go in and have a very creative conversation. On the same token, I've just never seen a human being kind of possess both sides of the brain like that. But anyway, great mentors for me. That's why I asked you earlier if there was someone who was kind of formative in your, you know, in your career. And I had that early on in my early 20s and really helped. I mean, well, then there was you, of course, but that's a different, that's more like the disciplinarian side and, you know, how things are done. And,
right.
You know.
Well, let me interject something here, Ryan, on Paul Frank and you, as it related to me, yes, you know, Ryan just went right through the paces. He ended up getting his degree. He ended up getting this amazing start with Massimo at the time. And he met Massimo. I think Massimo has told me that Ryan sort of stood out with this sort of fashion forward thinking. And he was very impressed with that and grabbed him out of the warehouse and brought him into the marketing department. And he was sort of the designated driver because he wasn't the party guy, but he went along with the program. And so to this day, Massimo just has the highest admiration for Ryan and on the creative side, so that when Ryan came over that fateful night, my version of that was he never really asked for the money. He sort of handed around. He was working at Massimo and parking cars to make extra money. He was a valet somewhere.
I was delivering pizzas.
Oh, man.
I've worked at Domino's and Pizza Hut and, oh, yeah.
Yeah, so I thought, let me get this straight. Yeah, as he mentioned, and I said, no, you've got this amazing job. You're going to end up there. And they're a public company at that time. No, you're going to put monkeys on T-shirts and wallets. What the hell are you thinking about? So for my wife, for Kim, I mean, she did have an understanding of that. And she actually felt like Ryan had what it takes to do something. And that was the seed money that kind of got him started, which is a whole different trajectory. It dwarfs what I did on a whole different frame. So,
I don't know about dwarf, but it's interesting that the paths that we've both been on, albeit by different motivations and, you know, different set of circumstances from, you know, upbringing, completely different, but really similar tracks. And it's funny because I never really considered myself to be entrepreneurial. I just knew I was virtually not employable and I don't take direction well. And I don't like working within systems because I feel like I see the hypocrisy and the redundancy within systems. And, you must have felt the same way, you know, where you're coming up and you're like, there's a different way to, I know that's what the protocol says and the book says. I'm not doing that. I'm going to rewrite the book. Had to have had that.
You're more of the rebel that way. I was more of a conformist. In other words, if you think back, because of I was still trying to put together a safety net for my family. I still had these dreams of the, you know, the waterfront house and the, you know, the European vacations and the nice cars, whatever the American dream was. And that sort of kept me being a student of what I had to do. I saw what you were doing was, talk about foreign to me. It was like, oh my God. And and you guys pulled it off.
We pulled it off.
And I remember, of course, pulling for you, especially as things started to take off. And maybe you could, you got to give a few minutes on the moonshot. But I encouraged Ryan to start a board of directors. And I said, and I want to be on it, not for any financial gain, certainly, but I thought I had something to contribute for him and what he was doing.
Yeah, I think, you know, once we had sort of teased out and proven the concept to you, and you had kind of seen us move from a couple small buildings to a really large facility, and again, starting to have distribution in Europe and in Japan and some of the key markets, I think it's when you were like, okay, hold on. Let me just give you a little bit of my, you know, some of my learnings here. And yes, setting up the board was critical. I mean, you co-signed on our loan, which I think, you know, banks were still not lending to the extent that we needed that kind of financing. Right. I owned a condo and a car. And they were like, yeah, okay, great, you know. But so I think without some of that formation, again, I don't know without your intervention there how much and to what extent we're growing.
To Ryan's credit, you know, I think probably some of his friends realized that I'd done okay. So they probably thought, well, yeah, Ryan's dad did this. That clearly isn't true. I did sign for a couple loans, of which they were prompt to pay and do what they had to do. I think I was instrumental in even introducing them to the bank. And the rest is on them. I did nothing. I gave mental help. Remember, because I had no safety net, I always have felt it's really important to provide safety nets to the kids, now the grandkids, and a legacy, which maybe we'll wrap up with, but that's it. And the rest is on him.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, it ended up being perfectly as it should be. You know, I had a rough partnership arrangement as well. So, you know, you helped guide me through some of that side too. You know, but ultimately I think we both, you know, ended up in a great place. I think I was silently and secretively in competition with you. Like I, you know, again, we grew up in a really great environment that you provided. But I always remember like, man, I want this. I think different motivation, but I'm like, yeah, I want this too. And oh yeah. And, but not like in a vindictive kind of way that I was a one-upmanship, but just, I like this lifestyle. I want to do it my way. And I remember when I graduated college and you said, we were mad at each other for this. I think it was a pretty sensitive thing at the time. You said, hey, you know, all these summers I've lined you up with this guy, this guy, and this guy. You know, where do you want to work? You're going to do outside sales and you're going to have a great career and you're going to have, you know, a nice life. And I said, I think I'd rather be some kind of, you know, position, you know, than doing something that doesn't feel intuitively good to me. I'm not going to wear a suit every day, and I don't want that life. And I think you were a pretty miffed because, but I just, the idea being that I needed to do it my way. I needed to have my own path, not the path that was protected. Like, as a good father, you were, I see the motivation, what you're doing.
Right. Well, you know, and you think back on those days, and of course, in hindsight, it's crystal clear. My motivation and your motivation. Yeah, and we were kind of, I wouldn't say at odds, but it was awkward because I kept thinking, no, Ryan, look at it. You can have yourself a really good life. You can, you don't need to do crazy things. And I mean, I remember the time that actually this happened in high school, that Ryan came home with three characters that were like completely, you know, these guys.
They were artsy. Yeah.
They were artsy guys, long hair.
Probably into some drugs.
Yeah. And I thought, who in the hell are these guys? And Ryan introduces me. This is my friend so-and-so and so-and-so. And I remember thinking, I got to jump in here. I don't know what's going on with Ryan. And I said to him, you know, I don't know who those guys are. And he goes, Dad, you don't know. They're really successful musicians. And, you know, one guy lives in a treehouse in Laguna, something like that.
They were signed to a major record label, like out of high school for music.
And I said, well, you know what you need to do, Ryan? And I never suspected that he ever did drugs, and he didn't. I said, you go upstairs and look in the mirror, and if in your heart of hearts you want to be like them, I said, then I support that. But you have to be the best. Mm. If you're not going to buy into that, then don't bother. It's just a waste of your time right now. And it's going to sidetrack you from whatever it is you're doing. And I think I hit home.
For sure.
And from that point on, he kind of had his own mind on what he wanted to do. And he had a circle of friends, I think, that were sort of the same mind. Oh, they weren't squeaky clean. They were hellraisers for sure. But that sort of led into his choosing a career of his own.
Yeah. Well, I'm really glad we got to do this. You're here in Boise, Idaho. You flew in. And it's nice we got the in-person. This is so much better, I feel like, than a phone conversation or a Zoom call where we're sharing our story. Just means a lot more to me that you're here with me and we got to do this today. You had a great story. It's definitely an against all odds type story. There was a lot that was not said and you had a lot of adversity and you know, really admire your perseverance and persistence and, you know, and all your guidance along the way in my career. And I hope that people that have been tuning into this maybe have taken something from each of us today that we've shared and that maybe we're making an impact somewhere else.
Me too. I feel a little awkward taking all this time to tell my story. I hope it's interesting to somebody. And this ride isn't done. I don't know. There's still some twists and turns to go. But now it's really... rewarding to me to have such an amazing family and all the love and support that exists. And I just want to create a platform of legacy for the rest of the kids to build on from there.
Well, I think we've committed this to audio and video, and I think they'll look at this and they'll get their own, they'll be able to reflect on each of us, I think, when they get old enough to understand this topic that we're talking about, and it's going to be interesting to see where they land.
Yeah, so that's right.
Yeah, so thank you, Dad.
Welcome.
Appreciate you being here.
Thank you, Rye. Love you. This is a good deal.
Love you too, bud.